Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the culinary wonders of urban New Jersey with a tour through Newark. We speak to Frank Mentisana at Phillips Academy Public Charter School.
This idea of family style and made from scratch lunches continues to be a bit of an anomaly in the city.
We also hear from Gil Speyer from All Points West Distillery.
Newark used to have an incredibly rich beverage alcohol history.
And we'll tour Arrow Farms, the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
We're growing using 390 times more productivity than field farming and 95% less water.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network to be amazed at the wonders of Newark. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. If you're just tuning in for the first time, all of the previous episodes of Feast Your Ears can be found in the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. I'm thankful for listeners like you, and I'd love it if you'd leave me a review wherever you find this podcast. Today's theme, cooking is fun. We live in a time of more and more information sharing, more studies on health and wellness, more brands, more travel. I mean, there's like a dozen companies who will ship a mattress right to your door. We have more available food and ingredients than ever, and yet it seems that few people cook for themselves or know anything about cooking. I'd like to think that balance is changing, but it's hard for me to tell from inside my own bubble. I talk about cooking and recipes all the time, but does everyone else? I care about where my food comes from, but does everyone else? I like exploring new-to-me ingredients in my kitchen and teaching my kids how to use a knife. But does everyone else? We're obsessed with efficiency and how to get more and more work, I read that as profit, out of our time and ourselves. I say make time to cook. Make time to sit down with your family and share a meal, not just once a week. Do it more. Cooking is a relaxing and engaging way to strengthen your brain, connect with your family, and you get a delicious sense of accomplishment when you put a meal on the table. I do it almost every day, and I love it. At the Brooklyn Kitchen, the cooking school that my wife Taylor runs, we're on a mission to teach people how to cook like grown adults. We believe that cooking for yourself, like reading, is something that all modern adults should know how to do. My guest today has been teaching people how to cook for more than 35 years and is one of the most important people in food today. She's the founder and chief instructor at the Ballymaloe Cookery School in Shanagarry, County Cork, Ireland. She's the author of more than 10 books, director of Slow Food Ireland, an accomplished television host, and she sits on many important panels on food and still finds time to spend with her 11 grandchildren. If you don't know who Dorina Allen is, you should, and you will after today's conversation. Thanks, Dorina, for taking a moment out of your busy schedule to chat today.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, that was really beautiful to listen to, you know, your priorities and everything there. And I hope people, I'm sure people will be inspired by them.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, it's been in no part inspired by you, so I have to thank you for that.
Thank you.
So I want to, you know, I in researching this this interview, and you know, you and I met a number of years ago in New York, actually at the Brooklyn Kitchen here. And I'm sorry that I missed you. Dorina is currently in Ireland, so we're talking by phone. I'm sitting in Bushwick, and she's back in Ireland, even though you were here last week. I wanted to sort of start a little bit at the beginning. I mean, I listened to a lot of interviews, and you talked about going to boarding school with the nuns and that sort of thing.
The Dominican nuns. Lovely, yes. Dominicans. Yeah.
But I wanted to, you know, sort of, you know, I guess start with how you ended up working in a kitchen. And it wasn't what you sort of wanted to do originally, but you actually took a job initially working for your future mother-in-law, right?
Yes, well, actually, back to the lovely Dominican nuns. I was at boarding school in the early 1960s, and the Dominican nuns were considered to be very visionary nuns. Indeed, they were.
Sure.
And at that stage, long before you were born, probably, they were encouraging us girls, because of course it was only girls in the school, to have a proper career, you know, do law, do the sciences, do medicine, architecture, whatever. But all I wanted to do was to cook or to garden. It was the only thing I knew anything about, really, from home and all of that. So, and I was quite the disappointment because I remember one of the nuns drawing herself up to her full height and saying, well, you're never going to need that, my dear. You know, why would you want to learn how to cook or to grow? You know, you're going to be a professional woman and you're going to have a career. And anyway, I persisted. And so then when they couldn't get me to do something else, they said, well, it has to be either a degree in horticulture or it has to be hotel management, because this was long before the time when chefs or cooks were even, their names were known, not to speak of having celebrity status. And it was also, ironically, very difficult for a woman, in fact, almost impossible for a woman to get into a restaurant kitchen. The men with the high chef's toques were chefs, and women just, you know, ran tea shops or kept out of mischief or something. So I was terribly lucky that, and in a funny way, you never know in your life what's the tiny thing that can change the course of the rest of your life, actually. And it was one day, one of the senior tutors in the college, who had a particular interest in me because she knew my mother from years earlier, asked whether I'd got a job, and was kind of thought I was hopeless when I hadn't got a job as an assistant manager, which is the sort of job most people would have got from my course, and they'd have had a little uniform and a little badge and would be all important. And it was another name for slave, really. Yeah. And but all I wanted to do was to cook. And so she told me I was far too fussy. But anyway, I also wanted to learn more about fresh herbs and how to make soufflés and terrines and homemade ice cream. I had a big thing about making, learning how to make homemade ice cream. And these were all very exotic in the 60s. And anyway, she told me, as I said, that I was too fussy. Why wouldn't I be like the rest of them? And then she said, funny, I was at a dinner party the other night and they were talking about this woman down in Cork. She's a farmer's wife and she seems to have opened a restaurant in her own house right out in the country, you know, near the sea. And she writes the menu every day, depending on what's in the, you know, what's in the garden and all the rest of this. Now, by the way, this is at a time when restaurants opened. They wrote the menu was the same 10 years later.
Sure.
So this was all kind of in incredulous tones. And she couldn't remember the woman's name. So and I said, my God. And she said, they have a Jersey here. They make their own ice cream and all the rest of it. And so I said, oh, my God, that sounds amazing. So she went away. And a few days later, she met me again. And she said, she handed me a piece of paper and she said, this is the name of that woman. Write to her. And the name on the piece of paper was Myrtle Allen, who subsequently became my mother-in-law. I became a member of the family by the simple expedient of marrying the boss's son. Yeah. So that's how it's done. So sorry, that's a big long answer to a very short question.
Like you said, I mean, you never know sort of what path your life is going to take. My aunt wanted to be a chef in the early 70s, and my grandfather, famously in the family, wouldn't let her go to culinary school. And it was only years later that she became a baker and became a professional in food.
Well, gosh, whoever is listening, I do really want to say, you know, either for yourself or indeed let's let our children follow their dream.
Absolutely.
Because so often, you know, it's tempting to try to live our children's lives, our lives or our missed lives through our children. And sometimes we can thwart them in doing what they really want to do. Unfortunately, I was fortunate to actually be able to do what I want to do. And you never do a day's work in your life when you're doing something you love doing.
Indeed, indeed. So you grew up the eldest of nine, and I believe you had a cow growing up, correct?
Oh yes. Well, I've always lived in the country. I love the country. I love to visit the city from time to time, but it would be absolute torture for me to live in a city because I'm very much a country girl, even though I'm now 70. yes, indeed, we lived in a little village in the Midlands of Ireland in County Leash called Cullahill, and we had a house cow, a Kerry cow, because my mother always, and as indeed Myrtle did, felt very strongly about the importance of us having raw milk, really good quality, fresh milk. And also, of course, we had hens, and we had, Mummy would rear with one of the men in the yard, chickens for the table, and we also had a kitchen garden and apple trees and all of that. And it was like, that was our norm. And Mommy right. loved to cook. I was really fortunate that my mother was a really good, what you, is certainly not a derogatory term, wonderful home cook. And, you know, did all, in fact, this afternoon, I just here, I came out of a cooking class at the cooking school, and I just did a steam pudding. One of the students had asked me to show them how to make a steam pudding. And I made a sort of jam pudding that she would have made in the winter. And, you know, that's what, in a way, and there, we have, one has so many happy memories of the food that we had as children, you know.
So tell me a little bit more. I mean, I think that, you know, here in the United States, certainly we don't have a clear idea. I mean, you know, I can't think of a single Irish restaurant that I'm aware of, you know, very specifically.
Well, plenty of Irish pubs over there.
Well, that's what I was going to say, right? I mean, I think Peter O'Toole famously said that his three favorite Irish foods were Guinness. So tell me a little bit about, I mean, you know, so what do you consider to be kind of some of the mainstays of Irish food that people should be paying attention to and should be making at home?
Yeah, well, honestly, you know, the food as in America and everywhere else, the food has changed dramatically, the whole food scene here in Ireland in the last 35 years. And whereas, you know, the cliched Irish stew and bacon and cabbage and champ and parsley sauce and the lovely soda breads and, you know, we have wonderful, of course, we're, as you know, an island nation. We have a long coastline, so we have wonderful fish and shellfish as well.
Yep.
So we have fantastic produce here in Ireland because a lot of fertile soil, no shortage of water, thank goodness, and also long growing seasons. So, but now in the last 25, 30 years, you know, the whole restaurant scene has changed incredibly. The young chefs travel all over the world. And actually does two things. Of course, they learn more, gives them extra confidence. But more than anything, what happens is the penny drops how good our produce is in Ireland. And you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. You have to start with good ingredients.
Yeah.
And here we have them in spades. And then we have one of the most exciting things that's happened on the Irish food scene, I suppose, in the last 25, 30 years, is the emergence of an artisan food sector, making farmhouse cheeses, you know, smoking fish, making cured meats, jams, chutneys, pickles, you know, cakes, home baking, also, and then people rearing lovely fat ducks and chickens and geese and all of that. So, and then the farmers market movement, of course, as well, which I actually, of all the things that I've been involved with in all the years, the thing that has, I feel most proud of, if I could say such a thing, is restarting the farmers market and movement.
Yeah, tell
in
me a
Ireland.
Little bit about that.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I was going to say, I was going to ask about the farmers market movement in Ireland and
yeah.
about your work to kind of, you know, you say restarted it. So can you tell me a little bit
yeah.
about the history
well,
and then
you know,
what work
the
you've
thing,
done?
This was actually inspired by a trip to San Francisco because I'm not sure if the market in the farmers market in San Francisco was the first new age farmers market in America, but certainly, oh golly, I don't know when this was, late 80s maybe or something.
Sure.
Basically, I went over to visit a friend, Mary Risley, who had a cooking school in San Francisco called Tante Marie's. I'm sure you remember
yep.
it. And at that stage, I remember I arrived in late at night and she said, look, we won't stay up late. We'll have a little glass of wine and a bit of cheese or something because I want you to be up at 7 in the morning to go to see this farmer's market. At that stage, it was in a parking lot. It wasn't even in the very plaza
sure.
building. And anyway, I said, no way. But anyway, she's even bossier than me. So basically, out she got me out of bed and down to see this. Oh, my God, it was like a light bulb moment. Suddenly, I saw all these wonderful stalls with, you know, professional people, actually, who had, you know, moved from the East Coast to the West Coast for lifestyle reasons, making bread, you know, growing flowers, rearing chickens, doing all sorts of things, and then selling on their stalls. And then I think it was Rose Pistoia, that restaurant, had moved down to the market on that day as well, because that was the place to see and be seen. And for me, this was an incredibly important moment, because of course, I'd seen lots of markets in Europe and France and Spain, Italy and all of that. But this was a different kind of market with a different sort of person, you know, selling, and they were so passionate about what they were doing and everything. And then it coincided with something happening here in Ireland. The supermarkets had come on stream, and the whole small shop thing had all changed a lot. And so suddenly a lot of the supermarkets were buying up some of the small shops, and they were going over to what they call a central distribution system. Yep. So the shop would ring up the center depot and order their stuff for the week. It would all come down in a truck and it would be delivered. And those shops would then penalize the local shops if they actually bought more than 2% of local produce. So suddenly, and a lot of people didn't realize this, local people who had a few acres of land and were growing a few cabbages and potatoes and, you know, and selling them into the local shop, and they'd get paid, and it would be kind of, they'd have a little chat everywhere they went, and it was part of their social life and everything, were suddenly told by the shop that they were no longer allowed to buy it. So suddenly, local people who had couldn't buy their local food any longer because it wasn't available in the local shop. And many of those farmers and producers were too small to go into central distribution. Now, this was happening kind of off the radar, where the general public consumer didn't realize it. But we knew about it because we buy from a lot of local producers for the Ballymaloe Cookery School here and for Ballymaloe House, and they were telling us about this. So suddenly here I am standing in the down in the parking lot there, wherever it was in San Francisco, and I suddenly think, oh my God, if I could restart, or if we could restart the market movement in Ireland again, local people could buy local food from the local farmers and producers who want to sell it. Otherwise, they couldn't meet because people are too busy to go out to farms every day and all that sort of thing. So I came back all fired up, told my mother-in-law about it, and the following year, we started a farmers market with about 8 or 10 stallholders, many of them who are still doing farmers markets, in the Coal Quay in Cork, where there'd been a market for over 400 years. That was in the city, and you know, much to the amusement of the third and fourth generation shawlies, as we call them, traders who always wore shawls.
Yeah.
And I was on television at the time, and they couldn't believe their eyes when they saw me standing behind a stall, because you have to understand that this was an extraordinary thing to do in Ireland because of our history. The idea of selling off a stall on the side of the street was anathema to Irish people because of our poverty in our past. So,
right.
You know, somebody said to me, well, what are you thinking of? You'd want to be on your knees to sell off a stall on the side of the street. But so I knew how important it was for me to be behind a stall and to be selling the lovely organic produce from our farm. And then there was Frank Heatherman with his lovely smoked fish beside me, Caroline Robinson with other vegetables. And basically, then people, actually it was even more interesting than that, because the Coal Quay in Cork is an area where the people who lived in Montanotti and Rochestown Road and all of that in Cork wouldn't be seen dead walking into that area of Cork. But when I was there behind a stall with a whole lot of others, they all started to come there.
Right.
And it got the whole thing going, and then we started another one in Middleton. Now there are about 160 farmers markets in Ireland.
Amazing.
And more actually. And many, many farmers would not, and they've told me many times, they would not be still on the land if it wasn't for the farmer's market. So if you're lucky enough to have a farmer's market close to you, and you have a wonderful one there in San Francisco, and I was in New York the other day, and of course there's a Union Square market there many days of the week, the biggest one on Saturday. My goodness, these people are heroes. They drive sometimes 2.5-3 hours to bring this beautiful produce to us, and every time you see them, you need to give them a big hug and tell them how wonderful they are. And pay them what they need to be paid for making that kind of, growing that and producing that kind of lovely food for us.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's such a, you know, it is so important that we now have the farmers market movement, and it's so nice to hear that it's going on in other places.
Yeah, it's real food. This
yeah.
is the sort of food we need, not edible food like substances, and as Michael Pollan says.
Yes.
And he's quite right, or ultra-processed food is killing us. And I don't use that word lightly now.
Yeah.
I use it absolutely intentionally. There's no question. Just real food, and to be able to cook, as you so rightly said, it means, you know, you're free. Otherwise, we're totally dependent on other people for the most important aspect of our lives, the food that we eat and nourish ourselves and our children with. And it's what, again, you also referred there to the importance, and I know everybody's so busy, but of making time to sit down around the kitchen table and even with your family and a few friends or whatever. And even if you're only arguing, you're keeping the lines of communication open.
It's a very good point. point. Definitely
it's worth it.
With my 9-year-old and 5-year-old, there's definitely a lot of arguing at the table, but it's good to remember that at least we're spending time together.
Well, they'll remember. They won't remember the arguments. They'll remember the flavors.
Absolutely. Mm. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors. And when we come back, I want to talk about a couple of your books.
Thank you.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise and affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sir Choix was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying our podcast? Heritage Radio Network has lots more. I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And together we host Why Food, a podcast about innovators, career changers, and entrepreneurs who are changing the face of food.
How did these folks decide to hit the brakes, start over, and become inspiring chefs, entrepreneurs, farmers, and activists they are today?
Browse episodes of Why Food wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and if you're just tuning in, I have on the phone all the way from Ireland, Darina Allen, who is the founder and chief instructor of the Ballymaloe Cookery School. Thanks, Darina, again for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
So you've written a number of books, I think more than 10 now, and I wanted to talk about one in particular, The Forgotten Skills of Cooking.
Oh, yes, indeed, yeah.
And I love the title of it, and I love the idea that we have probably forgotten more than we remember about cooking historically, as a culture or as a species, I suppose. But we keep adding things in, right? Like you see now the rise of things like the Instant Pot, which, while on the one hand I think is great because it means that people are cooking, it's a tool that people don't necessarily need, right? Yes, you can make stock in it, but you can make stock in any vessel you can put on the fire and you can heat. So I wanted to know, what do you think are some of the most relevant forgotten skills of cooking? Most people probably aren't going to go home and make their own butter unless they do have a cow in their yard, like you've been lucky enough to have for most of your life.
I'll go back to that in a minute. But yeah, but basically, the Instant Pot, I've seen that in America. And, I actually think that's a really good thing. I don't have one because you have a different voltage over there. But I mean, I was actually really intrigued by this because you can cook very slowly, you could use it as a pressure cooker.
Sure.
Et cetera. So and anything for me, anything that makes it easier for people to cook something in the kitchen and put it down on the table and share it is really worth having. And so I did, of all the things, I have no connection, needless to say, to the company or anything,
yeah.
But of all the things I've seen around, that's one of the better things by a long way.
Sure.
But anyway, the question there was tools, is it, or what was
it? Oh, I mean, it was just about forgotten skills.
The reason that Forgotten Skills book, which is about three books back, I think the next one I did after that was encouraging people to grow some food and mm-hmm. grow, cook, nourish, and which is another great big book. But the reason why I wrote that Forgotten Skills book was actually, again, triggered by an incident. I was in one of the kitchens one morning here in the school, and I suddenly saw a student dashing across the kitchen with a bowl, looking a bit flustered, quite close to lunchtime. And there was something about the way she looked that I said, oh, hang on a minute, what's in the bowl? And she said, oh, I was whipping cream and it's gone all funny. and I was going to give it to the hens. Now, normally in the kitchens, because we live here in the country, and we have about 600 hens in various flocks that, you know, so we have enough eggs for the cooking school and for the family and all that. And so there would be hens buckets in every kitchen, so the scraps from the morning's cooking, if they don't qualify for the stock pot, would go to the hens and come back as eggs a few days later. So that would normally be a good thing, to be giving it to the hens rather than throwing it out. And I looked into the bowl and I said, look, hang on a minute, you've just over-whipped it. It's just turning into butter. And she looked, I mean, even though this was on a 12-week certificate course here where we're teaching students, you know, to get with the skills so they can, you know, go into restaurant kitchens and so on. And she was here for a couple of weeks and she obviously knew that butter came from cream but had no idea how it got from cream to butter. Right. And I said, look, you've over-whipped it. It's just turning into butter, separating it from the buttermilk and the butter. And so I put it back on the machine, on the Kenwood, and beat it a bit more, and then it sort of slushed around the bowl, and the buttermilk came out, and then she could see the butter. And by that stage, half of the class was gathered around me, all wide-eyed. And I thought, oh, my God. All of these, none of them know how to make butter.
Right.
And you see, I was grew up. I'm 70 now, so I was born in 1948. But you know, when I was going on my school holidays, you didn't go to Lanzarote or Ibiza or somewhere. You were sent off to spend a couple of weeks with your relatives in Tipperary to get a bit of bog hair.
Yeah.
And my great aunt Lil made butter every couple of days, and you know, they killed pigs and made black and white puddings, all that sort of thing. So I just caught the end of an era there. So I just knew how to make butter from a child. So anyway, I poured off the buttermilk, washed off the butter, added some salt, and they were absolutely thrilled. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, this is just one of the many forgotten skills.
Sure.
So in other words, these wonderful young people who love to cook and everything would have just thrown this out without realizing that, look, you don't have to have a cow to make butter.
Yeah.
You can just, if you over whip cream instead of throwing it out, you just turn it into butter.
Yeah.
And so it's a basic skill. And so then that was the beginning of the Forgotten Skills book. And of course, it's everything from how to, you may not need this next week in Brooklyn, but how to, you know, skin a rabbit, how to prepare a rabbit, how to, you know, to make homemade sausages, how to fillet a fish, how to pluck a pheasant, all sorts of how to make, even for goodness sake, how to make bread there. And so it's quite a big book, as you know. And actually that book won the this is not a boast, really, it's just a fact, it won the Andre Simon Award, which is kind of the Oscars of cookbook awards over this side of the world. And it also really let me express my passion for passing on skills to the next generation. And nowadays it's super cool to be able to do all these things yourself as well. At that time it was just beginning to be cool again.
Sure.
I find that both the girls and the boys now, you know, they want to know how to pluck a pheasant or how to do all these things again, which is years ago people would just not want to have anything to do with it.
Sure. I mean, you mentioned we won't need that in Brooklyn. About, I don't know, a month ago or so, I got a text message from a friend who said, will you come over and help me kill my chickens?
Well, because
he knew that I knew how to do it, and he and his wife had chickens for 4 or 5 years and they had stopped laying regularly.
Yeah.
And it was time for the soup pot, but they didn't know how to do it. And so I went over there on a morning and I brought, you know, I told him how to do it, and I said, well, you have to kill them, they're your chickens, but I'll tell you what to do. And you know, we dispatched them.
And you can do it really humanely, and then you pluck it, and then the chicken make a lovely cockle van or whatever. It has an honorable end on a place, celebrated on your plate. How lovely is that?
Exactly. I love the story about the butter. I can just imagine, having done a lot of teaching myself, I mean, that sounds like one of those wonderful moments where you can see in all of the students' eyes the wheels turning in their brain when it finally clicks and they understand it. I remember when we first started doing pig butchering classes at the Brooklyn Kitchen back in 2007, that the moment where people saw this half a pig, and the moment in their brain as it started to be taken apart by the butcher, and they understood that it went sort of flip-flopped back and forth between being meat and being an animal.
Yeah.
In their head, and they came to understand that bacon is next to the pork chops. Watching those moments are my favorite when teaching classes.
I know, and also it's really important, if we eat meat and and that it's really good meat, and that the animals are really well and reared and humanely killed and everything. And that I know there's a huge vegan movement now, but I feel really I'm what you might call a flexitarian. Yeah. I have some meat and fish and vegetables and lovely plants and all of that. But I personally see absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever in rearing animals beautifully and then celebrating them.
Do you think that people in Ireland? I mean, so I have been to Ireland twice, and I absolutely love it. One of the most striking things for me that I remember upon the first time I landed at the Dublin airport was that you can see cows out the window the plane.
There's a lot of cows over here. We can grow grass like nowhere else in the world. So our dairy products, our butter, you get the lovely Kerrygold butter over there.
Yep.
And there's no question it's superb quality. And then, of course, our beef and our lamb that feed on that grass, of course, are also really beautiful quality. So yeah, we're very fortunate with that. But we also, next time you're coming now, we have a lovely airport in Cork, you know, right beside us here, about half an hour away, that you can fly directly into from, actually, Norwegian Airlines, I think, fly directly into Cork from Boston anyway, but otherwise from London.
Well, yeah, we'll have to come and visit. But I'm wondering if, because of that, do you think that Irish people are closer to their food at this point than a lot of Americans are? I mean, I think that America, especially in the city, I know you have cities in Ireland too, but because the country is somewhat smaller and is an island country, you know, and I feel like it, you know, I'm curious to know if you feel like people do have more of a connection to their food, or if it's part of this modern thing where we're all looking at our phones.
I'd love to tell you yes, but you know, we like to follow the American model a lot. And so, in fact, a lot of, in some ways, there are, not everybody now, because you can never, you know, say it's never black and white, but basically, people, in many cases, there's one and sometimes two generations now we've allowed out of our houses without giving them basic skills to feed themselves properly,
right,
which is desperately serious. And one of the things I hope I can see happen before I hang up my apron, and that won't be until I'm popping my socks pretty much, is that I'd like to see cooking re-embedded in the school curriculum.
Yep.
It's absolutely essential. We're failing in our duty to our young people to let them out of our houses without giving them the basic skills to feed themselves properly. And so they're totally dependent on, you know, takeouts or on other people to feed them. And I mean, also we're actually depriving them of the joy of cooking something themselves. I mean, you can cook, it's not rocket science to do a few simple little dishes, and you know, you'll never be short of friends. It's the easiest way to win friends and influence people. You can travel anywhere in the world, and the way to everybody's heart is still through a wonderful apple tart or lovely soda bread and butter or whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely. We're very lucky. I mean, my kids have access to a program called Wellness in the Schools that's in the New York City public schools that actually, I mean, they do a very good job of encouraging kids in the cafeteria to eat healthier foods. And then they have a class, I think, once a week. Each class gets to go and talk about food. And they do, you know, they do some minor cooking and stuff as is possible in elementary school.
Oh, it's the people who have the kids have that that actual opportunity are so fortunate. I mean, here at the Banbury Cooker School in East Cork in Ireland, we link in with 9 local schools, and we all of the schools must have a school garden and teach the children how to grow vegetables and herbs. And then we sent a chicken coop and 2 hens to all of the schools.
Oh, that's great.
So that the kids can learn how they keep the hens as well. And I reckon, you know, we had the Celtic Tiger period over here, then the whole economy collapsed in 2008. And from that on, I said, we have to teach as many kids in the local area how to cook as possible. And if they can cook and they can grow and they can learn, they know how to keep hens and have their own eggs and everything, it doesn't matter what the bankers do, basically, they'll be just fine. So it was giving them the basic skills. And then here, we also do transition extension year courses here at the school for, well, we do all kinds of courses, days, weekends, weeks, 3 months, everything. But for kids in their teens, you know, that are coming towards the end of their, what you would call your the high school time, and we teach them how to sow seeds and how to cook and how to bake and do things together. And they absolutely love it. And then they have a little kit of recipes that when they go to university or whatever, they can, to college, as you call it, they can cook for themselves and all of that. So that's one of the things that I love doing most, actually.
That's awesome. Well, we're getting near the end of our time together today on the phone, but I wanted to ask you for even just like an off the top of your head, not a specifically written out recipe, but is there something that you're cooking right now or something that reminds you of spring in Ireland that people should be looking at to cook?
Well, talk about spring. My goodness. The reality of climate change really came home to us this year, where normally asparagus is in season in May.
Yep.
And we grow quite a bit of asparagus and sea kale, which is another amazing, very special vegetable. We grow here on the farm, and we've eaten 3 meals of asparagus so far. And
wow.
This is before we had some before the end of February. I mean, absolutely spooky. It's not meant to be like that. And normally it would be May before we have asparagus. And we've also a sea kale, which we eat with the which is blanched, and we eat with a little hollandaise sauce on toast or whatever, or the first of the wild salmon. Basically, we had that the other night, and that's normally not in season until April.
Wow.
So those are two really beautiful foods that it's, and of course at the moment as well, there's lots of rhubarb. That's the new season's rhubarb. We're a little bit ahead in terms of season than you are
right.
There in New York and Brooklyn, but we have lots of lovely rhubarb pies, roast rhubarb.
I love rhubarb
with roast pork from the farm the other day. It's so good because it cuts the richness of the pork, and
absolutely.
That's really lovely.
Nice. And I wanted to ask, what's next for you? So, I mean, you still teach all the time. Do you have any books in the works?
We have students literally from all over the world here. There are 11 nationalities here at the moment, from the US, Australia, Japan, Zimbabwe, Romania, all over the place. And I teach, of course, I'm still here very hands-on, but we have one teacher with every 6 students. Mm. So it's the highest teacher-student ratio, I think, of any school almost anywhere. And we do bespoke courses as well. If people are coming over and they just have a certain number of days, they can contact us and we can do an afternoon or a day for them, depending on availability. And also, it's good for people to know that if they're in the area, if they're in Ireland and they're down in the Cork, East Cork area, they can come in for an afternoon cooking class and on any day. And you can look online, www.cookingisfun.ie, and then you can see exactly what we're going to be cooking that afternoon. You can have a taste of what's being cooked. And then our gardens and our organic farm is also open to the public all year round as well. And so people can literally just come in as part of their holiday, or else, of course, they can book on to a 2.5 day or a week course, or we do a 5-week one and a 12-week one and a 6-week sustainable food production course, but all sorts of things, and butchery and fermenting and foraging and how to make cheese and yogurt, all sorts of things, anything we think people might like to come to.
Well, it sounds incredible. I can't wait to come and visit, and perhaps we can collaborate.
Yes, indeed. It would be nice to see you again.
Well, thank you so much, Trina Allen, for joining me today on Feast Your Ears, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to rate and review the show if you like it, and please reach out if you have any questions. You can reach me via email, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on Instagram, @thefoodballer. You can follow Darina on Instagram, @Darina_Allen, and you can follow the Ballymaloe Cookery School on Instagram as well. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. for our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrationing happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.